like to welcome everyone to Women of Web 2.0. This is Cheryl Oakes coming to you live from Wells, Maine, and we are broadcasting on the worldbridges.net channels, and we are using the chat room in EdTech Talk. And we have a great show for you tonight. All the four Women of Web are here. Vicki just can't stand to be away for a minute, although she is totally immersed and exhausted from the Horizon Project. And I can understand why. I was late for work today reading one of the wikis for the one of the pages for the students. So I'm sure we're going to hear more about that. And my wow for the week, I received an email today from storylineonline.net. And I used to use it monthly when I was teaching in my elementary school lab. And I just loved it. And they have two new stories. It's supported by the Verizon Educational Foundation. And they have celebrities reading really excellent quality student books. So if you get a chance, try out storylineonline.net. It has online stories. They have activities. And it's just a wonderful resource. But my students used to love it. I used to leave a link up on our page so that they could go back to it. So that's my online wow of the week. And I'm going to move towards Miss Vicki before she nods off and falls asleep.
Yeah. Poor thing.
My wow of the week is actually, as you said, the students in the Horizon Project, which is we ended up with 53 contributors and amazed, and I'm going to drop in a couple of the project manager videos. Their job was to take video from all of the students in their group and to knit it together with an explanation, and some really incredible things have come out of it, and that's going to be my wow of the week. I'm going to drop them in the chat here. So I'm just stunned and amazed what students do when we give them the tools and we give them the empowerment and we point them in a direction, and it just shows that we don't need scripts and we don't need over structure. We can have a plan and a purpose and accomplish a lot with these tools. So anyway, that's my wow, and I'm going to pass it over to Jennifer in California.
Hello, this is Jennifer, and my wow of the week is something that, if I've mentioned before, I'm sorry, but I know that you know about the, oh, good, Bea can hear us.
Yay.
Oh, just a reminder to the chat room that you're on a 30-second delay, so we might not get your questions as quick as you type them. Anyway, my wow of the week is, if you've done the Vlatt Stanley project, I want to introduce you to a 4.5-foot doll whose name is Elwood, and he travels all around the world in a Rubbermaid trash can, and he will visit your school for 4 to 6 weeks. And I dropped the link in the chat room, and I'll drop it again so it doesn't get lost in all the other links. And if you want something to talk about at your school, having him at our school was one of the best things that we had ever done in regards to getting parents involved and kids involved, and there was just an excitement. And so I would invite you to check out Elwood. And Elwood's owner is a gentleman called Doug Hand, and he has traveled around the world for 25 years now. So it's a good thing to get involved in.
Mm.
And I will pass it to Sharon.
Hi, Sharon Peters here from Montreal, Canada. So great to be here tonight with the four of us plus Stephen Downs. We've been looking forward to this for a while now. And I've been holding back asking him questions for the last 10 minutes because I realized I wanted to be on air for this. So I'm really excited. I'll share my wows first. Like Vicki, I'm just so impressed with the students who have been working on their wiki projects, not just the Horizon project, but also I've been asked to be a judge for the Flat Planet Wiki project. Mm. That is a partnership between students in Oakville, Ontario, Canada, and London, England, and they've been doing one that has to do with environment, global change, and climate change, global warming, climate change, and it's just fantastic. And looking at my own students' work this past year, I'm just amazed that how much they can do when you give them the environment to do it. And to see student-generated content, it's just been a thrill this year to watch these kids collaborate together, both within class and then between classes. So I wanted to say to that, Vicki, I'm just so impressed with what your students, what all those students have been doing. The videos are great. Highly recommend viewing them. Wow. Well done on the editing. I saw the social networking one, and it was very impressive. The other small wow that I had is visual, and it's I'll just drop the link in the chat, and it's just a hilarious little visual of online communities. It's a map of online communities, and it just cracked me up. It was a sort of a good joke about MySpace and the far north. If you get a chance to take a look at it, you can see what I'm talking about. And by the way, one of my very own students passed that to me and emailed it to me because he knew I'd be interested in something that fun. So those are our wows for the week. And like I said, it's been great to be here with all four of us. And I know Vicki's feeling a little bit under the weather, and no doubt due to the way she's been pushing herself on Horizon. So I just wanted to make a note of that and introduce Stephen Downs. Stephen, you know, you've been around forever doing distance education, and I just can't wait to hear your perspective from what you've seen it grow into, because it's really become something that has become very web 1.0 flat, two-dimensional, to something that has a lot more potential with web 2.0. But I was wondering, first of all, if you could tell us what your job really is supposed to be for the National Research Council of Canada. I thought it was supposed to be blogging for all of us, that somebody paid you to blog, but I guess the Government of Canada expects you to be doing something else too, so I was wondering if you could describe your job for us.
Yeah, nobody knows what I'm really supposed to be doing. The job's titled researcher, and that's a deliciously vague title, and to a large degree, it's self-defined. Now, of course, NRC, it's a government agency, so they never leave anything alone like that. So they have sorts of things that they would like people to work on, and suggestions and ideas. But basically, what it's supposed to do is write papers, give talks, do original research, maybe do some software development, maybe do some commercial work, maybe do some collaborative things with companies for schools or colleges or whatever, something like that, hand wave. And so what I turned that into is doing the blog, or, you know, doing my website, my newsletter, of course, doing the talks. And it's funny, my main source, my main output has just turned out to be the talks that I give. That's where a lot of the new ideas that I come up with, that's where they come, trying to get something ready the night before. It's amazing how that pressure makes you think and try to come up with new ideas. But also, too, in doing the newsletter, I've spent a lot of time writing software, and it's not good software, it's not commercial software by any means, but I've learned an awful lot doing that, and that's helped me a lot. And I've got all the forms and everything handed into NRC, and I should be open sourcing that just as soon as somebody signs on the dotted line. That doesn't mean people will use it, but it means that it won't be like the secret software anymore, so that'll be nice. So that was pretty vague description, wasn't it?
Oh, I think it sounds like a cool job. It's like, is NRC hiring again? Like, because one of the things that I admire about what you do is that you're really a filter for the rest of us. That you go through, I don't know how you must be a speed reader. You go through so many sources of information on the web and then filter it for the rest of us who and comment on it and, you know, give us sort of a look at what's going on, a global view or a bird's eye view of what's happening in not only e-learning, but really trends, anything to do with web. So it sounds like a lot of fun to be able to do that, actually.
Well, it is a lot of fun, and I have a lot of freedom, and it's funny because I started in the newsletter like in 2001. It was basically originally me just trying to come up with a better way to handle my bookmarks. And then I'd write a little note to remind myself what it said. And then I thought, well, I should put it on the web. And then I thought, well, I should send it out in email. And it just sort of grew from there. It was never an intent, but, you know, it was something I started doing that proved to be useful to other people. So I kept doing it.
You've really become one of the original bloggers that have been out there. That's for sure. I wanted to jump into some of the questions that we had for you tonight and try to keep us sort of grounded in K-12 because it would be a lot of fun for me, especially to sort of go off and talk about neural nets and e-learning and all that stuff, but I really want to keep it so that it's relevant to our audience here. I picked up on your half an hour blog spot conversation with Christian Long last month, and I have put in part of what you had written in response to what he had said, and he had asked, how must we respond as educators and school designers if we are to offer relevant learning environments and programs for our students and communities' future? And I think this was in regard to School 2.0. That's what the topic was. And
yeah.
What you replied is there is no way we must respond and discussed how, I'll read it because I thought it was a little well put. I don't think I could paraphrase it nicely as you said it. What is at stake is not so much our children's education, which thanks to a wealth of freely accessible digital resources is now more assured than ever. Rather, what is at stake is our own relevance. That is, if there is anything of ourselves we want to put into what children learn, how are we to go about it? And it really inspired me, I know, for some presentations I did in April, and I had relevance at the top of the list to why Web 2.0 should be something educators should be taking a look at. But my question is, what are we losing out on by not being relevant to our students? And how can we make ourselves relevant?
It's one of these things that it's going to be different for each person, right? Because I think each person has something that they want to bring, you know, certainly to their children, if not to society as a whole. And that's going to vary from person to person. It might be their religion. It might be their political beliefs. It might be their sense of morality or justice or right and wrong. It might be, I don't know, a work ethic. All this whole range of things. The things that sort of loosely could be described, and I say very loosely because I don't want to imply that there's a single set here, but loosely could be described as social values or cultural values or something like that. And each of us has our own idea of what they should be. And if we're not part of our children's education, then these things won't be transmitted. I don't even want to use the word transmitted, but these things won't be modeled, won't be demonstrated to children. They won't see them in practice and in action. And when I say, well, there's nothing that we must do, it's because the students are going to get educated anyways. A lot of their education, actually, these days is happening outside of the schools. Certainly, their education and social values and ways of communicating, ways of socializing, they're learning these things at home when they're online after supper. They log on and go to Facebook or whatever. They're learning things when they send SMSs to each other or instant messages. So they're picking these things up regardless of what is done in the classroom, and they're picking these things up to a large degree independently of what's done in the classroom, especially if what's done in the classroom does not in any way touch on this other world. If what's done in the classroom is completely offline and separate, it becomes almost artificial. And so if we focus entirely on this offline world and don't focus or don't direct our energies to the places where they are online, then we don't shape that world, that online world at all. We don't get to demonstrate the sort of things that we think are important, and so they never see it. And am I babbling?
No. I think I appreciate what you're saying. And we do have a question from the chat room about how we can motivate the most irrelevant teachers who just don't understand that the importance of getting into online social spaces can be for touching base with students. Have you got any practical advice for that? That's a tough one.
My practical advice is really cynical. It's kind of wait for them to retire. There's a certain sense you can't force people, you can't convince people, you can't argue them into it. You can make their salary dependent on it, but they still won't do it. My experience has been the only way I can ever convince people that any of this stuff is useful is to do it myself. Even with my newsletter and what they're calling blogs now and all of that, that was me doing it myself, and you could see how I benefited from that. You could see how I began to learn things from it, and people seeing me do this, that made them say, well, gee, I could do that too, because he's not so smart. It's just what he's doing that gives him this sort of advantage. So.
Well, I'm wondering how that would work into, getting back to what about the relevance thing, about what you think about digital ethics, and that's become a really hot topic issue, especially, mm-hmm. I know, in schools and high schools in particular. Do you have a stance or advice on that particular issue? Because I think one of the graphics that you shared in one of your presentations where it talked about filters and how filters are worse for the students than porn and spam. So,
yeah.
If you've got any comments on that.
Well, I mean, I think about what sort of behavior you're modeling when you put filters on things or when you just turn off the system entirely. I mean, what you're hiding kids from these things, sure, obviously, and so in a sense, I guess you're protecting them, but you're also modeling the behavior that if you have a problem, the way you deal with it is you shut it down. And these kids are going to be out there in the world at some point, and they're not going to have somebody there to turn off Facebook or Skype or whatever, and they're going to need to have the tools to deal with it. And if their reaction is to to shut it down, they're not going to be it. If that's all they've ever seen, they're not going to have the tools to deal with this. So, I'm not going to stand here and advocate porn in the classroom. I'm not going to go that way. By the same token, they need to be exposed, or at least risk exposure to some things in order to be able to deal with it practically at all. You can't send them out to the world with no experience whatsoever.
I completely agree with that. And it's frustrating to watch the filter. I discovered at my school today that TeacherTube was filtered. I just about died. Wait a minute. That's supposed to happen.
I heard that. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
They were saying, we have TeacherTube because YouTube is filtered, so everybody has TeacherTube, and then now they filter TeacherTube. You just bang your head into a wall, and it's like, getting the concept here.
It was interesting today. I was in our library. And I just happened to be waiting to talk to someone. This is Cheryl Stephen. And I picked up People magazine and started flipping through People magazine, which I normally don't read. And by the time I got to the end of it, I said, and I'm worried about what we're filtering. This is, print. And it was really, not anything bad, but it was just that in-your-face stuff that is unfiltered in some of the magazines that come into our library. And this was in a middle school, and yet I'm thinking of all the things that have to be filtered through our middle school. It was just a real oxymoron.
And I just wanted to interject here. It was interesting on Monday, one of our students on the Virtual Worlds group was talking about child pornography being a problem in a specific virtual world. And as soon as he typed the word child pornography and saved, mm-hmm. our filter blocked the whole Horizon Project. So I had to go unblock it because I have access to the filter. But think about the people that would do a similar project that may not have access to the filter, that would have to ask, I need you to unblock this site that it says the word pornography on it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Amazing. I hope we can all get past that the filter thing, but I have a feeling it's going to get worse before it gets better. I had a question about Web 2.0 tools and how it's influenced e-learning. And actually, online learning in general, it could be a blended model as well. And I've seen a trend in the last year or so away from learning management and content management systems into more open learning environments such as wikis and blogs. Do you see that trend too? Is it just me, or is it a matter of maybe just of different tools for different needs? Or is there a perceived shift from content consumption to content production?
I think the trend is unmistakable, and the evidence for that is the learning management systems. Companies are actually adding some of these Web 2.0 tools to their learning management system. There was a session at our conference. So did you lose me?
Yes,
we did.
Yes.
Oh, my.
That's all right.
You were waxing eloquent, too.
How much of it did you miss? I had the actual voice thing minimized, so I didn't even notice when it went out. So.
You weren't the
guy. The answer was yes.
Okay. So I'm glad I'm not seeing things, that that's the trend that I thought I was seeing as well. And I personally like things more open, because as we've seen with the wiki projects, for example, the students get to have a worldwide audience as they go about presenting their student-driven content, and it gives them a much greater sense of, impetus and the motivation to do well. But I have a bone to pick about what I've seen of wikis and blogs and learning management systems, and that, to me, they're really not true wikis or blogs, because they're not open. They're closed within that system. So, I have a hard time with something I really can't RSS. If it's called a blog in a learning management system, but I can't RSS it openly, I don't know if
I'm sitting here nodding.
You're nodding. Okay. Oh, good. So I'm getting some validation there for that feeling, because I had this little mini argument with someone at a Moodle presentation last year. Oh, we have blogs in Moodle now, and I said, well, it's not a real blog, but. I guess for some environments, maybe some work environments, having a closed system is okay, because it's really meant to be between colleagues for sharing and that. But my feeling is that, blogs and wikis really are things that are open and can be RSS'd. I'm hoping maybe LMSs will, or CMSs, the companies that create them, or even the open source stuff, will find some way of making those tools, I guess, a part of their system, but still open.
I think the appeal of the LMS is that you can close it.
And
that's the marketing that they do. I mean, that's the value proposition that they put to institutions. It's not this whole wild west of Blogger or LiveJournal or MySpace. No, they say you can lock this down. You can control access. You can prevent people from seeing it. That's the marketing that they're doing, and that marketing works, because that's what a lot of these administrators want. And you talk to people that, even I was, in the sessions today, Terry Anderson, talking about, you have to have your class in private so that people can feel free to express themselves and all of that. And they don't want to leave the choice in the hand of the person who's making the comment or writing the blog post. They don't want to leave the choice in the hand of the student whether or not to make something open. They want to take that choice and make it for the entire class and say, no, this class will be closed. And, I think there's a variety of motivations for that. Some, just fear that students are, being too exposed online, that they'll expose themselves, maybe write information you shouldn't write. Others are just sensitive about what parents will say when they see what their children are actually saying. I think too that, maybe I'm a bit cynical, but I think it's a lot easier to impose control over an environment when that environment is closed and nobody can see in. And it's a lot easier to get away with things that you might not get away with if people really knew what you were up to. I don't know. I'm shrugging up because I still think my video's on and you can see. But I think people, administrators and teachers are as worried about protecting themselves as they are about protecting the kids. And that's the cynical view, but I think there's a lot to that, because the kids, They get out of their protected classroom. The first thing they do, they walk across the street, log on, and post something open on Facebook or MySpace. And I don't personally, I don't think it's particularly dangerous for them to do so. I mean, I'm waiting for somebody to give me the argument that certain danger is created by them doing this. I just don't see it. I mean, they walk down the road in full public view of everyone. What's dangerous about that? Well, yeah, there is an element of danger, but the real danger for them is when they get home. So, you know, I don't see the danger in having them post online, and I really see a value in them being able to connect with other people.
Very much so, and I think the big issue with Facebook at my school is our students setting up communities with this inappropriate motivation behind them, and I think I was reading even in today's Montreal Gazette of an instance of another high school where the students had set up a I guess you set up communities in Facebook where they were essentially, you know, going through the list of teachers and you know, going through the very negative attributes of these particular teachers and you know, whether it was true or not, and the public school board went a bind and they're wringing their hands. They're not sure how much control they have over this. And yes, but the danger is anyone at that school teaching them how to communicate appropriately in those online social spaces? Are they given opportunities to do so? You know,
and that's where we come back to modeling the values that you think are important.
Mm-hmm.
If you think it's inappropriate to make fun of teachers, you know, just shutting down Facebook or prohibiting them from using Facebook isn't going to send that message, because you know, you're not even part of their community. You're just somebody who just comes in and turns things off. Well, no value statement is communicated by that, except maybe you have more power and authority. But I think that if you're in that community and you see them expressing, and then you can respond to that expression, and it becomes not so much an authority and punishment thing, but a, you know, well, this person that you're talking about, they're online, and you're actually saying it to them, did you know that? And all of a sudden, you know, they may have a different reaction, thinking, well, maybe this isn't so secret after all. I know I'm sort of speculating out loud here, but I just see almost any sort of interaction as being better than simply turning off the system.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
When I was in the class at our high school, and talking about Facebook, and we were first talking about research and different ways to do online research, and then somebody was talking about doing a project for their social science class, and they were going to do on MySpace and Facebook, and I said, oh, I have accounts in those, and 20 heads popped up and looked like, uh-oh.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're right. We have to be there.
I have mentioned this before, but there's a really neat initiative going on at my school, the head boy and the head girl. I've become so concerned about the way the students are inappropriately representing themselves on places like Facebook that they're going to, in a closed meeting situation, sit down with some of the younger students and point out some of the dangers of inappropriate postings and posting of photos, posting of comments, whatever. And I thought, wow, that is terrific. That's student leadership. It's student-driven. And it's quite powerful, I think, to the younger students, rather than these adults who don't have a clue what social networks are all about, saying no, 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 no. So I'm hoping I can sit down with the students after they're finished with this and have a good conversation and audio record it for a podcast, because I think it's a really terrific model.
Oh, yeah.
Did you ever see that video? It was... where they treated a bulletin board in a classroom as though it was one of these online things. And the person puts up the photograph. And that's a great video.
That's
too bad you can't access it because it's blocked. But it's, you know, that's getting the message across.
I did pass that on to my administration, actually, who are helping the head boy and the head girl do this, so that may get to them. It's a big issue, and I don't think we're through grappling with it, and I think more parents should be out there getting into Facebook and MySpace. And I finally was able to bribe one of my students into inviting me to the Facebook at school. So I'm there now. Mm-hmm. And occasionally my daughters let me see their own Facebook entries, so that's kind of kind of nice, too. But I guess it's, too, it's a matter of trust, and I trust my two daughters because I know who they are, and I know they have good sense about how they represent themselves online. But we're a very digitized household, you know, so they know, we know, and there's conversation and back and forth, and it's a good relationship. And I think at bottom, what you're right, Stephen, is having good relationships with your students / children to build those values that you want to transmit on to them.
But, you know, that's just like when people talk about technology and the pedagogy at school. It's the same thing. It's the technology and the family relationship. You know, if you don't have a good family dynamic happening, the technology can only make it worse. So if there's no respect, no conversation.
Right. No trust.
Right.
Right, that can, those kinds of things can actually be magnified or amplified, in a way. Right. I want to push the conversation to similar sorts of topics, but talking about virtual learning environments. And Stephen, you did a really terrific presentation back last November that I listened to the very evening that you actually did it. It was, I believe, to some Canadian educators and administrators. And you were introducing Web 2.0 to them, and I think they were really a group that were not familiar with these topics at all, because you said, I don't see a single laptop here. And there's no internet access in this hotel. How could that be? But you talked about how this has changed e-learning, and I think you were talking about the future of e-learning. I think it was the topic of your conversation. And you talked about personalized or individualized virtual learning environments. And this is a topic that's really of interest to me. And I'm wondering, is there any one software that does what you suggested, or is what you're suggesting really like a personal knowledge network that a person is drawing together on their own through RSS feeds, blogs, wikis? I don't know if you could maybe define that for us.
Well, okay, there is no software, no specific piece of software that does this yet. So there is no application called the personal learning environment. There will be. Someone's going to produce one. There have been some prototypes. CS and Scott Wilson in Britain produced something called Plex, which I think stands for personal learning environment example. Something like that. I've messed around with something called RSS Writer, which just barely works. And sooner or later some company, because it's a concept that's really caught on, a lot of discussion about it, so some company's going to come out with something like a personal learning environment. There's been some discussion about whether we should even think of it as a learning environment. And I think that discussion is well taken, because one of the things that I've said and others have said is that we have this tendency to separate living from learning, or learning from living. It's as though learning is something that we get up and go into the other room or into some special building to do, when really, especially online, learning and living are really part of the same sort of thing. So it's more like a personal environment rather than a personal learning environment. And if you sort of look at it that way, then a lot of these Web 2.0 tools, as they begin to integrate more, they're sort of becoming like what a personal learning environment might be. There's a generic term, the word webtop, which describes a class of applications that allows you to connect to a bunch of different Web 2.0 tools at the same time, to subscribe to RSS feeds, to to access widgets of some sort or another, and basically to set up your web page as though it was a desktop with all the handy dandy tools that you might need to interact with different systems here and there. During the conference today, the personal learning environment was described almost as an attitude or a perspective whereby you understand that you can't read everything, and so you're picking and choosing things that will filter, and the personal learning environment becomes the way you add new sources or delete sources that aren't working for you, and just that sort of information management. But I think it's more than that. I personally think that the creation aspect is huge, that if it's just, you know, content consumption, it's no real advantage. That the personal learning environment has to be not simply a place where you get material, read material, view material, but where you take what you've received through RSS and other applications and mix it up, mash it up, rework it, create something new with it. So it's a workspace. You know, we were at an NRC creating something called, it was originally called PAM, Project Activity Management, and then it became Project Activity Tracking or System, PATS. And what it was basically was a way for researchers to manage their work. And the way I described then what I thought it should look like is, it should be the, when you log on the computer, it should be the thing that you open up where you're going to do your work. And right now, we don't have that, right? We open up Word or we open up our email application, all of that sort of thing. We don't have the thing that we open up. Maybe the closest thing is, you know, the browser. But even the browser, you know, it's, you know, you have the browser and the email and the other stuff as well. So it's that sort of thing that brings things together. But, you know, it's going to be a trick to pull off. Technologically, I think it'll be a trick to pull off because there are standards like RSS, but there's a lot of things that aren't standard, like the Google API or the Flickr API. And so there's a real balancing act taking place there behind the scenes. Did that help?
Oh, not sure. So there's no one virtual learning environment that, okay.
Right.
Okay, you know, maybe this is a good way to dovetail into what you presented today about learning environments versus learning content, because in your abstract for your CADE presentation, you said that future development and distance learning, therefore, ought to be directed toward enhancement of the learning environment rather than specification of learning content.
Yeah.
I would love to hear a little bit more about that.
Gee, I wish you'd referred to a presentation that had gone better.
Oh, no!
Well, it was a bit of a stretch. The actual presentation was a bit of a stretch. It's interesting. There's a rainbow outside the window.
Winnipeg.
Yeah. I guess there's a thunderstorm in the horizon. It could be like 100 kilometers away because everything's completely flat here. And there's a rainbow. Anyhow, because there's this tendency, and I see it a lot. There's this tendency to, when some sort of new technology comes along, to say, well, how can we use that to present content? You know, like, how can we take a game and make the game teach people something? Or how can we take video and make video teach people something? And so there's this focus on treating any of these technologies as some sort of transportation vehicle for the thing that we're trying to teach. And I don't really think that that's the most effective way to go, partially because I don't think that people acquire content that way. I don't think that you send content, a person receives it, that's how they learn. I don't think that is how they learn. I think that the way they learn is by being in an environment and by interacting, practicing, doing things in that environment. You know, that's why we make them do exercises. That's why we make them solve problems at the end of the chapter. That's where they're doing the learning, more so than when they're sitting there being told about something.
Right.
And so thinking about that then, and also thinking about the sorts of things that people want to do, or what do they want to do? They want to play games online. They want to make MySpace profiles. They want to go to YouTube, all of that. It becomes a question of, okay, understanding that these total environments will shape their learning rather than this content that we're sending through the environment, so that we need to attend to, well, I don't want to just repeat it. So you see, the presentation didn't go well, so I'm still struggling with it. But you know, attend to the environment as a whole. I'm still struggling with explaining this. But you see, go ahead.
I was talking with somebody today about this concept, and you know, what we came to conclusion was that perhaps the best learning environment is one that permits the best relationship forming and relationship engagement between people, because that would be a part of active learning too. So, you know, would that be a part of what you're saying? An environment that could best permit relationship building, formation, and engagement would be one.
It depends on the person.
It probably depends on the task.
You know, like something like that's great for extroverts. Introverts, yeah, not so hot. Somebody who's introverted is going to want something that will, like, maybe handle that for them so that they don't have to do it, or, you know, I can't even describe that. But now that's the thing. Each one of these environments, and the reason why we talk about things like a personal learning environment, each one of these environments is individualized to a person's interests and tastes, and it's not a teaching vehicle at all. It's the place where they do the thing that they want to do. I used to talk about, one day I'll actually do this, a thing called a budget simulator, where people who are interested in the federal budget, they have access to this whole system where they can design the budget for themselves. And this system is tied into the learning materials that they might call on if they want. The learning materials aren't necessarily part of the system. And it's tied into communication, chat, and discussions with other people who are also building budgets if they want, but they don't have to. And you can do it as a group, but you don't have to. And you can see, as you're building these budgets, you can see what other people are doing. You can see what the actual government is doing. And I will comment that the government eventually will have to listen to the budget builders, because, you know, it gets harder and harder for the government to do something different than what all the budget builders are doing. It's just almost like budget blogs, except they're actual budgets. And, you know, the learning is almost incidental in that sort of thing. You're trying to do something. You're trying to create a budget. You're not trying to learn finances or mathematics or statistics or accounting. You know, you're trying to allocate resources to things that you think should be supported, or you're trying to accomplish some sort of political task and say, here's how I think the country should be run. You see the distinction there between trying to learn something and trying to do something? And the environment that I'm talking about is the thing that we're using when trying to do something. This is why it's so hard to describe, because everybody's trying to do different things. An environment might be a dartboard on a wall and the darts that I'm using, and somehow we want the learning to be accessible and available within that environment. How do you put learning in a dart? Well, it can be done. I don't know how. You might have to put it, you know, well, you throw a dart, the dart complains. You know, or something like that, because it's got, you know, it's got a little tiny gyroscope and an RFID chip in it, and, you know, the dart sends a signal, 42, that signal's interpreted on a website, and then that feeds into the speaker in your head, and the message is, you know, a little too much overdraft in that throat, don't you think, mate? you know.
It was interesting that you, go ahead, finish up.
Well, there isn't much more. It's just, if we always think we focus on trying to teach people content rather than helping them do what they want to do, especially at the lower ages. And you know, I think that we would be so much more effective in teaching if we stopped trying to do it so overtly and just tried to help people do whatever it is that they want to do more effectively.
If Cheryl, if you weren't going to jump in, I had a couple things.
I was just going to say it was, you know, it was interesting to talk about the introverted learner and the extroverted learner. And, you know, it just had me thinking about, you know, we need to differentiate. You know, there are ways that we can do that, especially through the technology. But, that, I mean, that's just great teaching.
Well, yeah, it would be great teaching if it was done. You know, and I mean, like, I'm not on the extrovert side. I'm on the introvert side, yet I went through my entire educational career with one teacher after another trying to force me into group work.
Mm-hmm.
And I hated that. And it wasn't helping me learn because
right.
I was too busy dealing with the dynamics of the group and getting over all of that. I didn't have any chance to, you know, just try to get out of this group as soon as I could. But so, you know, we have our presumptions, and even now, you know, even at this conference that I'm at and various other things, there's always this, oh, yeah, the new learning, it's all collaborative, it's all working as a group and doing things together. Well, that works for some people, but, you know, it's very easy, and I think that there's a predisposition on the part of teachers to favor the extrovert side because, well, most people are extroverts, and I think even an even greater percentage of teachers are extroverts.
We have to be.
I think people are finding that with wikis and blogs that you can allow a place for that introvert in your class to have a voice.
Right.
And I don't think that it has to be, you know, the loudest voice, but the written opportunity gives everybody equal footing. Well, not really equal because
Sure.
you're not a good writer, but it gives you an equal chance at that.
Yeah. It helps a lot until you make them write with someone else and
right.
then you just shut them down.
Yep.
But it's tricky. I mean, it's tricky to attend to what, you know, people's individual traits.
Well, I wanted to go back to the conversation that you had with Christian Long because one of the people that's actually here in the discussion, the chat group today, wrote and you had a conversation back and forth with her about her her take on what you had written, and it was she had asked, are you suggesting that students take co-op positions in place of traditional education, or in addition to some kind of supplementary education, and your response was, I think of them less as positions, which implies some sort of employer job type of relationship, but more as projects, which suggests something they do because it interests them. And yes, in the long term, this approach should replace traditional learning, because sitting in a room of 30 people waiting while the teacher tries to impose order is really unproductive. I agree with you on that. I hate those moments. And, oh, man. And I agree that, you know, this is, people should be able to pursue what their passion is, and that they should be seeking and learning what they want to. But, you know, again, I was talking with someone about this idea today, and we talked, well, what about those people that are not intrinsically motivated to learn? I have a son who's that way. So this is something very near and dear to my heart. So, you know, if I could invent intrinsic motivation and then sell it, I'd be a rich woman. But in the meantime, I'm just wondering how we deal with the not so intrinsically motivated students who just you know, it seems like you put them into almost any environment. Although, you know, my son really likes video games and simulations and role playing sorts of things,
and RuneScape,
and we haven't talked about actually your take on those kinds of things in its place in education. So maybe that would be a good segue into that. But you know, intrinsic motivation is one of those really tricky things, and I'm not sure what place it has in this conversation about learning, the best learning environments.
Well, you see, there's motivation to learn, and then there's motivation to learn the things that you think that they should learn. There's motivation to act, and then there's motivation to act in the ways that you think that they should act, or to, you know, Rune, right? There's motivation to sit for 20 hours on a computer and play Rune, or there's motivation to read a book as you think they should, you see. And
right.
I think that the number of people that would actually sit there and do nothing can be counted on one hand. And you know, we can have special programs for them. But I think, you know, everybody learns, especially kids. And kids are learning machines. They're learning all the time. You try to keep kids still and not doing anything. You know, they want to be doing something. And so it becomes not such a question of motivation. They are motivated. They're just not motivated the way you think they should be. But it seems, especially with, you know, an environment where we can actually take the learning and deliver it to wherever they are, or that's, you know, eventually that's the way it goes, to follow them where they want to go. So if somebody wants to play Rune, you know, eventually they'll get really good at Rune and they'll want to move on to something else. But, you know, okay, you say, well, okay, this person really wants to play Rune. Let's look at this and say, you know, what is their, I don't even know how I want to say it, but because I don't want to change Rune into learn the alphabet, or, you know, I don't want it to be like learn trigonometry Rune, but I want, you know, I want the games, like when somebody is playing a game like Rune, they are learning. They are learning. And so, you know, we want to have an influence in how these games are designed. I play SimCity a lot. SimCity is a great game. The problem is anytime that you want development to happen in your city, you lower taxes. And you can sort of see the message in there, right? So if you want to see our sort of values reflected, then we need to play a role in the design of these games. And in the making of these games available. Otherwise, they will just pick the game where you lower taxes to get progress. But, you know, I really think that they are learning things. And, oh, I had an end to that sentence, and I've forgotten it.
Oh, and I completely agree. I mean, what I see my son doing, he's negotiating, he's collaborating, there's a goal that he's got to reach toward when he's playing these games.
He's
some really valuable.
Other people.
He's teaching other people, he's learning how to communicate, you know, in this environment, and making choices about what he wants to pursue.
I just remembered my,
Okay, go ahead.
There was a discussion today. Kids today, they're typing all the time, they're writing all the time. Think about this. They're writing all the time. And that's just in these things that we're trying to block them from doing. Right? But they're writing all the time. We're going to have a generation of kids who, because they've been reading and writing since a very young age and doing it constantly, they're going to be incredibly literate. Hmm. And we won't know what to do with that. We'll take credit for it, but we won't know what to do with that. So I'm a lot less worried. You know, I mean, and again, it comes back to where we started the show with, right? You know, they will be educated one way or another. And what we're influencing them is not whether or not they learn, but, you know, how much of ourselves are we putting into that environment, into that place where they are, in fact, learning. And if we don't put any of ourselves into those environments, then they won't see ourselves. They won't see our values and our way of life, whatever that may be.
And I, you know, I've said it before, and I'll say it again. I've never seen the digital gap between generations so profoundly as I'm witnessing it now between parents and children. Because, you know, parents just don't understand. They don't get it. They don't understand. They can't see the powerful force that these social networking sites, that text messaging, instant messaging, all of these things that their children are spending hours doing. They just don't understand it, and they try to control it. And it can't be controlled. It's so grassroots. It's so it's like the what's the mythological creature where you cut off the head and three more pop out? You know, it's a bit like that. It's a Hydra. It's like the Hydra. You can't get away from it. It's really exploding. So, you know, do we ignore it? Do we try to shut it down, or do we try to educate them? on how to do this right, or at least come down to their level and talk with them about it. So, anyway, we've got the 5-minute warning. Okay,
yeah.
Are there any questions in the chat room while we have our 5-minute warning? This has been a great conversation,
yeah.
By the way.
Yeah.
It's been very, very good. You know, maybe as we're waiting for some chat questions to come up, what trends do you see happening, Steve, in education that you would want to remark upon, Stephen?
The sleeper hit of the year, and the thing that really is going to have an impact is the we.
Oh,
wow. I don't think people...
We've got one of those.
Sure,
we got one of those.
I'm not slightly surprised. Because the reason why it's so huge is because the previous computing experience where you sat there and typed and worked with the screen has now been replaced with a whole body experience and consequently a much more immersive environment than we were in before.
Mm-hmm.
And right now the games are all like physical games like baseball or boxing or things like that. But, you know, I mean, that kind of interaction is going to become a lot more sophisticated. And so I think people are going to see with the Wii for the first time that computing, and indeed even online learning, doesn't necessarily mean the computer. That the learning can take place and should take place away from the computer. That doesn't mean that we're going off to the computer. It just means that there's this separation happening between ourselves and the printed text on the screen. That was badly expressed, but you sort of see where I'm going with that, I think.
Yeah, I think that we, you know, Jen's been really into the Wii, and she's been blogging about, you know, her vision for it as well. I just know that I throw my arm out when I bowl too much on the Wii. And I'm really good at that. That's why I do the bowling thing, is because I'm the star bowler in the family. But it's quite engaging. It's true. It's got that kinesthetic quality to it that has been missing, I think, from a lot of the virtual games. And for me, it was kind of like, wow, I can finally beat my son at something on a video game.
Yeah.
That was huge.
I know Jen has a question.
Well, I had to say, too, I just started Weight Watchers 2 weeks ago, and I've lost 5 pounds, and most of it's due to my Wii, because
yeah.
I am playing tennis hard for an hour every night. And I'm I'm just waiting till they make it so the friends that I mingle with,
mm-hmm.
who we're sharing emails with, and they appear on the side of my screen, I can't wait till we can play interactively.
That's right.
That's going to take it even to a new level.
Have they reached that point yet? Because I know there's wireless, but
we can communicate through
okay.
email, and
okay.
I can see them on my screen,
mm-hmm.
but we cannot play against each other yet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
okay.
Not in the games
problem.
I have so
it's
far.
You're facing the problem of the speed of light.
Yeah,
and
I want it.
Yeah.
I'm serious.
Yes.
The speed of light is a finite quality. It takes a certain amount of finite time for a signal to go from their computer to your computer, and that finite time creates a gap between you seeing what's on the screen and you reacting. And when you're playing tennis, a tenth of a second gap between you swinging and the racket moving
could be
really off.
Could be a big deal.
Well, no, there have been studies on this, and the latency problem has been serious enough that it actually makes people sick. So,
wow.
Yeah, there are still some issues with that. So they'll have to solve it with the software, so what appears on the screen appears to be instantaneous for each of the two players. I'm sure it can
right.
be solved programmatically,
mm-hmm.
but
mm-hmm.
I don't think it's going to be easy, because you have to almost anticipate what they're doing before they do it.
Yeah.
And
well,
send the signal before they actually take the action.
Wow.
I did have a personal question, if I could. It's not too personal, don't worry. I was very intimidated when I was first introduced to your blogs, not knowing that you pulled from a lot of sources too. I just thought you are very well written and very well spoken and very articulate on your blog. But the day that I just really warmed up to you and was like, oh, my gosh, was the day that you blogged about your cat. So I was just wondering how many cats you have now And because one of the things that you read was wrote about that your cat was one of the first to either have a web page or a blog, and that just made you so personable and so approachable. So I just wanted you to share a little bit about your feline family,
yeah,
if you could.
The cat that her name was her name was Norman, which is a stupid name for a female cat. So I got her. She had a name when I got her. She was this little tiny ball of fluff. And back in 1986, and I had her for 17 years. And she was the first
wow.
cat in the province of Manitoba to have her own web page. So I called her the original Cyber Kitty, which
oh
my. She was. And she was. So yeah. Then after that, I knew Poets couldn't just be replaced. So then we got three cats, Bart, Polly, and Nadia. And Nadia died, sadly, I'm not sure how, it was a few months ago, over the winter, which is, you know, sort of, oh, geez, not again. And, you know, it's funny because Nadia was the most like Pudge. She was calico, and she was such a sweet little cat. She would fly through the air. You wouldn't believe. Like, cats are pretty mobile anyways, but she lived in three dimensions her whole life. And so it took a little bit because she did die in the winter. But we got two more cats. Alex and Alexandra, or we say Alex and Lexi, who are feral, very feral. I think they're actually wild cats of some sort. They're the most interesting cats, and I haven't blogged about them because we got them, but Alex had some sort of infection. No, he still does. He sneezes, and so I was sort of afraid. I don't want to blog about them, and then write about the death of another cat. Kept Alex going. It was touch and go for a while, but it looks like he'll be okay. I think I'm not. He's still an issue, but so we have four cats, and they're all. And I know it's a long, winded
no,
end
I
to
just,
your question,
I just think that's great that you, because you're so prolific, if I can say that on your blog, that you interjected that totally personable side. And I thought that was really, wonderful.
Well, thanks, I guess. I couldn't write any other way, honestly.
Yeah.
I don't see, people talk about writing objectively and all of that, but to me, everything I write is personal, whether it's about online learning or whether it's about my cat, it's all personal. I'm writing about myself when I write. I'm writing about what I'm thinking about, what I believe, what I see, what I do, all of that.
Well, do we want to end this and then go into a little post-show? Because
sure.
I know that Sharon wanted to entertain one more thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let's remind everybody that we have Brian Crosby on for next week.
Yay,
Brian Crosby is learningismessy.com, his blog, if you want to follow it. And we hope that he'll have some exciting news to share next week about some opportunities that are coming up in his classroom.
Terrific.
Okay. And Cheryl, you want to take us out and then bring us
back
in?
I sure do.
Great.
I just have to say, Stephen, your voice is so musical to me. I could listen to you all night. It's just been great. This is Cheryl Oakes for Women of Web 2.0, and I would just want to say a huge thank you to Jeff Lebo at worldbridges.net for allowing us to webcast on the World Bridges channel, and thanks to Dave Cormier at edtechtalk.com for us being able to use the chat, and there has been a load of chat happening tonight in the background, so you can catch all of this as a podcast and a chat, usually by Thursday at www.edtechtalk.com. And this is Cheryl for Women of Web, over and out.
Thank you so much, Stephen. It was fantastic.
Yes,
and we can.
It was great.
I don't know if you can entertain a couple more questions, because it looks like Ryan had a question about how does Stephen see getting schooled and the public and the decision makers to finally decide changes need to happen in education?
The short answer is by bypassing them.
By bypassing them.
You're not gonna change their minds. Forget it. You're not gonna change their minds. It's not gonna happen. So you root around them. They're a system error.
They're a system error. That's priceless. So is it the grassroots that is going to sort of skirt around that? Is that how you see it? Well, and Web 2.0 really facilitates that, but is that what you...
Sure. Well, by the time they finish scooting around it, they won't be so grassroots anymore. But the short answer is yes. I mean... it's people deciding that they can't wait for those who are in charge to take the lead and people just deciding to do these things themselves. I mean, my whole career is that. If I had waited for management or administration to approve whatever it is that I wanted to do, I never would have done any of it. One of my favorite stories is back when I first started at Assiniboine Community College. This is back in 1995. I said, well, the college should have a website. And they said, well, no, it's not possible on our network. Our network is the right kind of network to have a website. So I went home. I found a web server that would run on Windows 3.1, which is what I had, and I tested it at home, and it worked fine. So I went back to the office, installed the same server on my office computer, and that worked. And then I walked down to computer services and said, go to this address. That's my website. It's running on a college computer right now. It's accessible to the world at large. I think we can run a website. And we got a website. Well, that was the college website. I ran the college website.